This podcast is intended for investment professionals only.
Hello and welcome to this update from Elgium. I'm Max Julius, Head of Content, and I'm delighted to be joined by a bumper cast for our final CIO call of the year. We're joined by Sonia Loud, CIO, Howie Lee, Global Head of Index and ETFs, Will Riley, Head of Solutions, and Chris Jeffrey, Head of Rates and Inflation Strategy. Good afternoon, everyone.
Good afternoon. Good afternoon.
Well,
it's like a chorus to hear that, the way it came across.
That's right. Perfectly timed. Well, even as we all look towards next year, the macro news flow for 2023 keeps coming as we're in another central bank heavy week. But today we're going to dig into some of the most potent insights from our 2024 investment outlook, which we published only last week. Sonia, you've joked recently that you're growing tired of calling each passing year extraordinary. What have investors learned in another highly unusual year for markets?
Thanks, Max. And I think it has been an extraordinary year, but you're obviously right. Eventually, when you've done this 4 years in a row, you have to wonder whether there's some normality, at least in what we have experienced. But it's very clear that the year after the aggressive rate hikes, you know, that we would see a number of adjustment processes. But what has been remarkable clearly has been the speed with which the market has adjusted to any new data point incoming. And what is very surprising is to see the everything rally that has started at the end of November. And it is important for investors to bear in mind, because if that's the starting point, how much better can it get when we move into 2024? And so we have, we framed our narrative for next year with a number of questions. And the first one inevitably is the one around growth, inflation, and the monetary policy reaction function, because it's very clear, and it's been evident in the everything rally, that the soft landing now is priced in. So any disappointment in growth next year inevitably will lead to earnings revisions being downgraded. And I don't think this will be very positive for risk assets in general. So the balancing act that has dominated 2023 will obviously be a key input in 2024. And we believe particularly the first half will be dominated by this. The reason why it's so important, because the market is expecting rate cuts to occur next year. And again, this has been more than priced in and is more than expected. So again, we have to be very mindful what is next if that is not coming to pass. The surprise of 2023 has been the strength in the US economy. So not surprisingly, it will be all eyes on whether, in fact, interest rates will eventually slow down the US economy or not. And it's very clear that this will have probably the most profound implications, because it's been the surprise there that has fed into the soft landing narrative that, as I said just now, is clearly what is priced by markets. So related to this is the story of rates, i.e. will we see the Table Mountain or is it Mount Everest, i.e. how aggressive can central banks actually react and cut rates? But it's clear from our point of view, unless we will see a recession, we might see that the expected rate cuts might be too optimistic. So again, another area to look out for. Thirdly, fiscal support. It has been the big surprising element for the US economy this year, driving particularly the second quarter results. So the question is, not only can it repeat itself in 2024, and it's not only if not, will it actually detract from economic growth? Because we know there's lots of debates ongoing. To be fair, this is not just a US phenomenon. We are having a live debate in Europe as well around the fiscal framework. And we might watch out very carefully what role fiscal will play next year. The fourth one is the market reaction function. I think fixed income investors might suffer a little bit of whiplash this year because the magnitude of swings we have seen across bond markets has been quite extraordinary. And so really, if we are seeing more surprises around the narrative on growth and inflation, hopefully at least volatility will not be quite as aggressive, but we should be prepared that this might be the case. Another highlight, the Magnificent Seven. Should investors expect another chapter in 2024? Again, very important. So looking at earnings revisions, if we look at the S&P 500, earnings revisions currently expect plus 11%. So overall, that's something to look out for because it wouldn't fit a recessionary environment and could be a major disappointment next year. And then last but not least, what is incredibly important for next year is the move from rates to politics, as we called it, because we are seeing roughly half the world population going to the polls next year. We will have the Taiwanese election in January. We will have India going to the polls in April, May. And then obviously it will be all eyes on the US, which probably is the most important of all the elections next year. But it is important. And all the points I've highlighted around fiscal in particular and the way how this can shape markets next year, probably more towards the second half than the first. But that is kind of the couple of points that we have highlighted that clearly will frame next year's setup. Now, the long term is equally important, and we would be amiss not mentioning geopolitics. And clearly, elections will have a major role to play how geopolitics will shape up next year. And so this is not necessarily what we would say will drive markets immediately. But as we said for a number of times now, it is important to understand how this will shape structural drivers and with that structural investment opportunities.
Well, thank you so very much for that comprehensive overview. There's quite a lot there for us to unpick over the call, and let's return to some of those themes. And Chris, Sonia has just talked about the rally. We've seen how much is left on the table there. How does our asset allocation team expect risk assets to perform next year, and where do you see the biggest opportunities and risks?
So Sonia's covered a lot, so I'm just going to kind of pick up a few other bits. I mean, the way that we kind of think about the world economy is a bit like a three-legged stool. So we have, in big picture terms, you've got China, Europe, and the US, and everybody else doesn't really matter that much just because those are the centers of gravity. China's been struggling with structural headwinds all year. We don't really see any case for that changing next year. There isn't the sort of policy incentive to go for the big macro stimulus that we've seen in the past. Europe, if I take Europe and the UK together, been flirting with recession for the last 6 months, basically not grown since Q4 2022, and struggling with the transition to a higher structure of rates, which is feeding through pretty slowly. And that feed through will carry on next year, which leaves us with the US, where the consumer has surprised us and surprised most people in the market by holding up very well over the last 12 months. So, you know, kind of three-legged stool that's standing on one leg, continue to stand? Yes. Is it stable? Absolutely not. So it just means that there's lots of risks associated with that kind of one pole of support. Sonia's highlighted the fiscal one. We could also look to the potential adjustment in the housing market that so far has been in deep freezer in the US because of the structure of the mortgage market rate. Mortgage market, you've had big lift in rates, not really a big adjustment in house prices, just a kind of collapse in transactions. So overall, that doesn't leave us massively optimistic about next year. But it's not all doom and gloom. So the pockets that we definitely highlight as being interesting is the kind of mid-risk assets, which now have yields which investors could only have dreamt of a few years ago. And some of them have been repricing in a way that's created, we think, quite interesting opportunities. So, you know, to highlight one, renewable infrastructure assets we know are going to be absolutely central to the climate transition over the course of the next couple of decades. But they've had horrible performance looking backwards. So, you know, people who believe in that multi-year, multi-decade transition have potentially have an entry point that is very attractive. In terms of risks for next year, yeah, Sonia's highlighted most of them. It's really hard to not worry about the US presidential election. There's uncertainty about fiscal policy, tariff policy, environmental policy, and even monetary policy that spills from it. It's the 5th of November, so remember the 5th of November, 2024. And then I think it's interesting, the one that's not on the list of things to worry about, like the UK election that we all know has got to happen by the spring of 2025, is not on our list of concerns in a way that it might have been during previous electoral cycles. The gilt market, sterling, and UK equity markets have been pretty relaxed, and I think are likely to remain pretty relaxed on that front, given the narrowing policy differentials between the two major parties.
Thanks very much, Chris. It's a very colourful imagery there. We've had mountains with Sonia stalls now. I wonder where next we'll go for imagery. Howie, which long-term investment themes are you most excited about for 2024?
Oh, Max, I've got a long list, but I did promise to keep this as concise as I can. Of course, we talked about the Magnificent Seven earlier, but I have talked about artificial intelligence and cybersecurity in the past, and I think that's obviously going to be a really obvious theme. But actually, what I'd like to talk more about is around the integration of sustainability or responsible investing and those considerations into portfolios and managing the risk accordingly. I mean, although it's not quite 2024 yet, we have already engaged on this actually across a number of asset classes. So whether that's the sovereign risk framework for government bonds, you know, there's innovation there that we're really focused on, especially as historically that innovation has been focused on credit. Where there's also continued interest, of course, in decarbonization. And so, you know, the way that we think about the future world approach or other custom decarbonization pathway, again, that is part of the same theme. And of course, our excitement extends across our investments floor, whether it's through our kind of climate action work or themes such as clean energy, hydrogen, and energy storage. And actually for 2024, we're also extremely excited about commodities which are required for a transitioning economy, not usually found in standard commodity benchmarks. So in summary, quite a bit to be excited about relating to how we can help clients navigate through this climate and transition challenges. And I suppose we're also trying to share this thought leadership here as a member or co-lead of the index workstream of Glasgow Financial Alliance for Net Zero. And that's really bringing together asset owners and our industry together to encourage broader adoption of net zero investing through indices.
Well, thanks, Harry. That's very clear. It's very timely that you mentioned these ESG areas, because, of course, today is the end of COP28. Well, it's fair to say, thankfully, that this year has been far less dramatic for LDI strategies than 2022. Chris touched earlier about how sterling assets have been less exciting of late.
Well, they're always exciting. different ways.
So, yeah. Forgive me. Yeah. Differently exciting. Yeah. What's top of mind for DB schemes as they look ahead to next year?
Yeah, I think if you take a look at the UK DB market, we are at a very sort of key inflection point, right? In terms of, you know, what Sonia was talking about in terms of being an extraordinary year, you know, going from the LDI crisis now to where we are now in gilt yields and even credit spreads to an extent, you are seeing a lot of clients now being in a much better funder position in the UK DB market, right? So to give you three sort of separate data points, the main one out there obviously is the PPF funding level, which, you know, a lot of that data started about 17 years ago. Its lowest was at 76%. And we're now at the end of October, it's almost twice that level. It's at 147% or 0.5% funding level. Another data point is when we were in October, we had the LGIM client conference where we surveyed our clients there. 45% have said they'd reached full funding on a buyout basis. And 22%, an additional 22%, were well funded on with a buyout surplus. So that's 2/3 of our clients that we surveyed then that were on a full funding basis. And then the last data point is I'm also privy to LNG have commissioned the Centre of Economics and Business Strategy, where we've done a big survey of the larger pension scheme responsible over 400 billion of DB pension promises. And, you know, some of the key statistics, I don't want to take a lot of what they're going to be announcing in the new year when they release this, but some of the things that have come out of there are really interesting. So from that survey, approximately 2/3 of those clients are now thinking about endgame. And then you're sitting with another 75% of the 2/3 that are currently investigating or have already investigated changing their investment strategy in order to be focused on endgame. So it's quite clear, you know, schemes are preparing for this. They're thinking about how they need to now start investing like an insurer. They've been trying to take advantage of this fortuitous increase in yields, right, that is now backed up. And we've now seen this in November, a bit of the rallies, but, you know, the long end across the UK and also globally. But it's about how they were going to now take advantage of that and not see those gains that they've made in their funding ratios not disappear, and make sure that we can, you know, before rates potentially start falling even further, lock in a lot of those gains that they've made in their funding ratios.
Thanks. Well, it really has been a remarkable journey, especially when you think back only a few years ago to the days when we were worried about kind of gaping deficits to where we are today. Well, Sonia, you touched on earlier quite a number of possible catalysts for markets next year. Why is scenario analysis so important to us when thinking about how the market narrative might evolve in 2024?
I hope it is relatively straightforward, because it's very clear that if you consider that, well, what both Chris and I have mentioned around the growth outlook, there is right now a very strong conviction that that we will see a soft landing. Now, with a soft landing will come a different pathway for interest rates. And as such, it is very important to understand the consequences. If you start with growth and you think through how different growth profiles will have an influence on monetary policy and as such, obviously, on rates and equity markets, it's very clear that with where we are, you need to make sure you have a full picture of the potential look through. And given that we don't know yet, it is important to give it a probability of different scenarios. But it does help to think through different scenarios and obviously have then a better understanding how different data points might shape your thinking. It is important as well, because we have talked about politics. We've talked about the number of elections that will come up as next year. Just looking at the US, the US election, and Chris has highlighted some of the very important topics that will come up on the campaign trail that can shape the narrative in very, very different directions. So in order to capture the implications this will have on markets, you inevitably have to consider various scenarios in order to capture a holistic picture, but you have to be very disciplined that you stick to the probabilities that are data-driven, and when you have evidence that you go forward with that relevant scenario. But I think the level of uncertainty we have been experiencing is only going up, because the broader the geopolitical narrative, the more influencing factors you have. The more influencing factors you have that are not economic, the more you have to consider in scenarios to get the full picture.
Thanks, Sonia. That's a very useful framework for thinking about that sort of wall of uncertainty we're looking at next year, especially in terms of politics. Now, within the emerging markets complex, of course, is very much impacted by some of the geopolitical uncertainty we've just discussed. As a house, we see particular opportunities in India, partly as a result of technical factors. Do you want to talk us through some of those?
Yeah, you know what? It's probably most exciting in the bond space at the moment. I think most people would have captured the news from JP Morgan in the emerging market index that they have finally decided to add India government bonds into the index from June 2024 next year. Now, we've been waiting for this for a number of years, and it's a pretty big event, because when that happens from June 2024, it's going to be phased in, and it's going to ultimately end at a full 10% inclusion. So that's the same weight as China. And that's a pretty significant event. Now, it's going to be managed pretty well, because it's 1% a month, over the next 10 months. But by the end of it, it means that actually there will be more foreign ownership of Indian government bonds when this program is over. In fact, by 2030, it is estimated that foreign ownership of Indian government bonds will rise from 2% to 9% in 2030. So actually, with recent bond price pressure, the higher yields will have investors looking at this asset class. Some will probably be looking at the opportunity to gain exposure ahead of this full inclusion, to essentially avoid buying at a period of peak demand. So perhaps this can be seen as a potential active position to capitalize on potential for post-inclusion spread compression.
Okay, thanks, Howard. Chris, please.
Yeah, so I think this is a really interesting story, and I think it's interesting because the starting numbers are so low. So if it was similar to emerging markets in Eastern Europe or in Latin America, you'd have foreign ownership that was already 25-30%, like in some of those markets it's up to 40%, which inevitably means that you've got high co-movement between those markets and all of the other markets where the same foreign participants are so active. But here, like, we kind of think fundamentally about what does it mean when foreigners hold so little. Is that domestics entirely drive the market? I mean, that's going to give you diversification, and if we can agree on one thing that's a good idea for multi-asset portfolios or bond portfolios, it's, most people would sign up to diversification as being a principle they agree with.
Thanks, Chris. Let's return exactly to that point of diversification very shortly in the call. Chris, going back, that's Will. Going back to your comments about Endgame, you write in our CIO Outlook that credits can play an important role for schemes.
Yeah.
Why do you think this is, especially when the market outlook is quite murky?
Yeah, I mean, I think the big point, when clients are considering trying to hedge their buyout price, I mean, credit becomes this increasingly important risk that you need to have in order to make sure that you don't miss out on the buyout, right? So if you look at where credit allocations have been increasing, and from the latest purple book, you know, they now make up to 25% of the scheme's asset allocation, right? So that's allocations to public investment grade, high yield, and private debt. If you think of what an insurer will be allocating, they'll be closer to something like 50. So there is a lot of risk that you need to be thinking about how you align your portfolio relative to where that target needs to be. I think the other interesting stats from that survey I was hinting at earlier was, there were a couple of questions asked around where do we see these big schemes in 5 years' time? Where are they going to be allocating to? And the first thing they were going to be allocating is LDI credit and cash flow generative assets. So we see a material increase in those, right? So in terms of trying to increase allocations to matching adjustment eligible credit, that's going to be a key thing that they're going to try and be maximizing over the next 5 years. And two-thirds of the people surveyed said they're going to be increasing that liquid corporate credit. And then more than 50% said they're going to be increasing their secure income. So there's going to be this push towards assets that can give you that credit exposure, but then also give you sort of higher higher yield coming from those asset classes. The other thing that sort of was interesting around the survey was they actually were thinking more around decreasing and not increasing allocations to liquid assets. And this is largely real estate and alternatives. But if you're thinking about a buyout, you are thinking about where is the liquidity in my portfolio and how can I get ready for that move across to an insurer. And I think some of the things that have been happening quite interestingly in the market this year in terms of a buyout is you're definitely getting insurance and investment firms coming up with this sort of joint investment proposal about how to be able to dispose those alternatives and be able to either take on some of those assets in specie, accepting some of those assets and financing them through a deferred premium, or offering a deferred premium with a backstop to allow schemes to be able to sell those assets and retain the value. So, going back to the whole point around the inflection point, I think while others might not, see it as the most tactical time to be making the allocation to credit, there's definitely this sort of wave of demand out there in terms of downward pressure on credit spreads that you'll have from UKDB in terms of trying to increase their allocations, over the next 5 years.
Thanks. Well, let's stay with the theme of asset allocation and return, Chris, to your point about diversification. It has been a tough few years for diversified portfolios. Could 2024 be the year of a multi-asset revival?
So, I mean, ultimately, it all kind of hinges on the inflation outlook. So if we have inflation that ebbs away back towards central bank targets, then the kind of secure cash flow assets that Will's been talking about, the kind of the assets where the discount rate is particularly important rather than varying expectations about future cash flows will inevitably do quite well. I mean, our economists are clear in warning that we shouldn't expect the easy rides automatically. Just because it has been easy thus far to bring inflation back down doesn't mean that that last mile is going to be easy going, that there's going to be bumps in the road. I work on a multi-asset team. I'd love to say that, yes, definitely, 2024 is going to be the year of the multi-asset revival, but that'd be a bit disingenuous. The thing I want to say with more conviction is that we think 2024 could be the year of European revival. So, one of the reasons that multi-asset has been struggling is it's sort of struggling by comparison with a US stock market that has been going gangbusters for a decade. Now, we've had excess returns on US large cap stocks of nearly 12% annualized for 10 years. That's A, extraordinarily unusual for that to be so persistent, and B, you need to think quite carefully about, well, what does it imply if we think that kind of thing can be repeated from this starting point of pretty compressed earnings yields and pretty high risk-free rates? It's possible, clearly it's possible that that US exceptionalism will carry on. But for 2024, we think that European revival can be the theme. We've seen kind of downbeat sentiment across the board on European macro and European earnings outlook. So the bar is pretty low for sort of positive surprise. I mean, Europe doesn't tip into an ongoing unpleasant recession. That'll be a positive surprise relative to the way that most people look at it. The valuations are pretty compelling. The kind of cash flows that European assets, both credit and equity, can offer versus US assets are pretty compelling. So yeah, I'd love to say 2024 is going to be the year of multi-asset revival, but the thing I'm willing to say with more confidence is it's hopefully the year of European revival.
Okay, thanks, Chris. That's very clear. Well, with Sonia, we're approaching the end of the call, close to where we actually started it, talking of rallies and what next. We've touched on more than a few topics to consider next year. What are the key takeaways for investors, and is there anything you'd like to add?
Thanks, Max. Before I do that, I would like to come back to the emerging market topic, because we believe that there's actually a very positive fundamental story helping all the technicalities that we have talked about. And it's one important factor, and it's actually a differentiating factor, is the fact that central banks in emerging markets have proactively raised rates when the inflationary shock hit, compared to in the developed world, where we all know we were a bit slow in starting the rate hikes against the inflationary backdrop. That means they're in a better position already now to address the overall environment. And if you look at the overall macro backdrop, it looks very, very constructive. And we should not forget as well that India now is actually the growth engine compared to the woes that have unfolded in China. So there's actually a lot going for it. And that's not surprising that we actually do like emerging market debt, not only from an overall point of view, but in active positioning as well. So with that in mind, and I thought it is important because that's the positive angle. Not surprisingly, with everything we have said, we are underweight risk, because we believe that the expectations are just too positive. And if you look at where valuations levels and index levels now are, a lot has to go right for this to continue. And we believe the risk of disappointment is clearly not priced anywhere. I would agree with Chris that risk is highest in the US. I've mentioned earlier that we are expecting 11% earnings growth in the US, which is in complete contradiction to the expectation that actually the economy is going to slow down, I think on consensus basis, down to 0.5. We are obviously a bit more negative because we do believe that the tighter monetary policy will have a bigger impact. But regardless, it is a significant slowdown. And in comparison, analysts are still seeing significant increase in earnings. History would suggest that doesn't exist, and it will inevitably leave investors disappointed and equity markets under pressure. In that context, if we are right with our recessionary call duration, i.e. rates will work well, as they always have been. But it's important, I think, to take then the longer term picture. And this is why what Will has said is so important, because clients really will look at the outcome they need to achieve in order to make sense of it all. So we are urging investors to really look at the various valuation levels and the risk they have been taking in their portfolios. I actually do believe in diversification will matter a lot more, because we cannot assume that the return levels that we have been achieving over the past 10 years or so are repetitive. And as such, the understanding of the opportunity sets is far more nuanced than making a beta call on US equities. This is why we always pick up the themes, our thinking behind where we do see the opportunities. And we are seeing this reflected as well, how clients are engaging with us and how we can help them to deliver the outcome they're coming forward with and engage with us.
Thank you, Sonia. And of course, we'll gather this time next year to discuss and see how these themes have played out. Finally, I'd just like to ask you what you're planning on watching, reading or listening to over the holidays. I'll get the ball rolling and say I've been listening to the audiobook of The End of the Affair by Graham Greene. It's read by Colin Firth, and it's just wonderful. Sonia, over to you.
Ah, it's Christmas time, so it has to be The Grinch, it has to be Arthur Christmas, and it has to be Christmas Carols in the Royal Albert Hall.
Some classics there. Chris?
I mean, I disagree that After Christmas is a classic. I've been reading and planning to continue with a book called His Majesty's Airship, which is a fantastic story of the UK's ill-fated experimentation with hydrogen-filled airships in the 1930s. You can guess how it ends.
Explosive volume.
You can guess how it ends, but it's just a fascinating story of like hubris gone crazy. And I suppose if I really wanted to stretch for a parallel, it's about, you know, the importance of risk control that was notably absent during that episode in the 30s. But it's really, really good read.
Fascinating. Nicely done there as well, the parallel. Howie, over to you.
Yeah, so recent Santa exchange. I've got eight books. So I've got eight books to read. That's the first thing over the Christmas holidays. Definitely be watching Nightmare Before Christmas, a family tradition, and probably going through my 90s catalog of music because I was recently given and went to watch Prodigy, and that's kind of ignited some 90s vibe in me. So I think I'll be listening to that over the holidays.
Thanks. I have some big tunes. Will?
Yeah. We get a sort of family tradition, which is Dylan for One. And there's a sort of TV program, which is always hilarious. And so we watch that. But in terms of reading, a good friend gave me a book, The Silk Roads, which by Peter Frankopan, so I've read that, and there's the new Silk Roads, which is now where I want to sort of move on to next. But it's a bit of a story around the Middle East, what's happening, the history around that, Central Asia, and the move sort of India and China. So it's very, very relevant to obviously what's happening now in politics and in the world. So
you see the funniest piece is that Dinner for One actually is most popular in Germany.
Oh, wow.
In Germany, everyone watches Dinner for One. Because if you ask here in the UK, I mean, we can ask around the table whether you all actually know what it is. But in Germany, you can ask it. Everybody knows.
Never heard
of it. In South Africa, they do this. It's big in South Africa, so they watch it there. So,
I've heard of it, but only from my German colleagues.
I think I need to look this up.
Yeah. It's hilarious. It honestly is very, very funny.
Fascinating. Well, that's a great point on which to end this month's call. Thank you, Sonia, Chris, Howie and Will, for your time today. Thank you to you, our clients and listeners, for joining us. You can find our 2024 outlook on the Elgin website. You can also find our latest updates on our social media channels, the Elgin blog, and of course, here on Elgin Talks. From all of us here on the CIO call, we wish you and your loved ones a wonderful festive season and a very happy new year.
As a reminder, this podcast is intended for investment professionals only and shouldn't be shared with a non-professional audience. This podcast should not be taken as an invitation to deal in legal and general investments. Any views expressed during this recording belong to the individuals and are based on market conditions at the time of the recording and do not reflect the views of legal and general investment management. Forward-looking statements are, by their nature, subject to significant risks and uncertainties and are based on internal forecasts and assumptions and should not be relied upon. Where individual stocks are mentioned, these do not constitute a recommendation to buy or sell any security and are for illustrative purposes only. Legal & General Investment Management Limited is authorised and regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority. For full terms and conditions, please visit our website. To find more content, you can check us out on Twitter, LinkedIn and our website. Copyright 2023. Legal & General Investment Management Limited. All rights reserved. No part of this publication may be reproduced or transmitted in any form or by any means, including photocopying and recording, without the written permission of the publishers. This material is issued by Legal & General Investment Management Asia Limited, the licensed corporation BBB 488, regulated by the Hong Kong Securities and Futures Commission. For professional investors only.